Doctor, Bryant said, share with us your pearls of wisdom, enlighten us lesser mortals. The doctor had called story time again. This time, however, the windows were open, daylight shone through the windows, and there were no refreshments. Tell me, how do plants eat?
Two ways, said Tim. The first is photosynthesis, sunlight and leaves, and the second, nutrient absorption through root systems.
Petra looked at the little figure wired up to the AMU. Even strapped down, she still wouldn't go near the thing. Are you saying this troll is a plant? I'm saying this is Carl Baring, having suffered massive cellular invasion by a root system controlling him and using him to look for nutrients. In a way, he's more like a berry, a fruit. The coats and plastic sheet cut him loose from the tree.
Tim giggled. You were joking.
Why? The doctor seemed genuinely surprised. I thought you were a botanist. Next you'll be telling me you've never heard of crinoids.
I haven't.
The Spheriosis landed billions of years back in Earth's past. It plopped into the primordial mud and began to grow. Took geological ages, but it's grown very big.
How can you know this?
The doctor walked to the window. He looked through murky glass at the bare hills. Could have been tiny at first, he said aloud. A nut, a seed, even a single cell. The planet cooling around it. And gradually, as years turned to centuries, to millennia, to eons, it crept up to the surface. Growing, absorbing, sending out its roots and feelers, learning all the time, absorbing knowledge as well as food. What a marvellous little Spheriosis you are, my friend. Good on you. Bryant, Petra and the others were all thinking the same thought. At what exact point had the doctor joined Katie Baring in the safe realms of madness? So, asked Bryant, what do we do? Its size could be made to work against it, the doctor answered. Like all life, it needs food, and right now it isn't getting any. Remember the children's story? The troll comes out from under the bridge when the harvests are bad. Remember the 1830s? Corn laws? Agricultural riots? Napoleon? He looked around, expecting confirmation, and saw none. History? No? Hands up here who went to school. Talking of fairy stories, said Bryant, what you're telling us is all well and good, but what about some practical advice? The doctor thought for a second as if he didn't know, then chirped up with,
you could always leave.
Petra nodded vigorously. You see, yes.
We've worked too hard, said Tim,
surprising the doctor. No, said Bryant. Let me remind everyone, we are talking past tense. We have burned this so-called creature. That whole area is nothing more than a charred lump. Also, we have its little pet in captivity. All we need to do is find Carl Baring and go home. Listen, the doctor insisted. This life form has been evolving almost as long as this planet has existed. The Spheriosis has turned from a dormant seed into a highly complex and dangerous predator with roots and pseudopods soaked through this whole area. How do you think it manages to manipulate the soil? There are trillions of tiny fibres binding the ground together. I have no idea how far it has spread or the kind of strength it can muster. Now, you can stay and let it overwhelm the whole farm and everyone inside it, or you can go. Those are the easy options. What are the hard options?
The doctor rubbed his chin.
I haven't done with leaving yet.
I have.
What about Charlie? Asked Petra. And Campbell?
Her words silenced the room. We should know, said Tim. Tell us.
The doctor faced them. This is a barren land. The Spheriosis is like any living creature. In the face of starvation, it finds food in whatever form it can.
Vanessa turned white. You mean, it ate them?
The doctor's broad smile returned to his face. Ingested, probably very slowly. Now, hands up who doesn't want to leave? There was a general murmur of relief. Evacuation. That was an option they could all understand. There came a crackling from the couch, the sound of plastic being torn. Somehow, the troll sat up. Its dark eye holes stared blankly at the room.
Oh God, no!
Vanessa once again fainted dead away. The troll raised an arm. The gesture was weak, and its chest heaved with exertion. It made no sound.
How did it break the straps? Asked Tim.
It didn't, the doctor replied. Now they looked, they could see the doctor was right. As the creature sat up, the plastic restraints passed through the body,
like it was made of mud.
"Don't touch it," shouted Lieutenant Chavez.
"Like there's any danger of that," Petra muttered.
The troll dropped to the carpet. It looked up, and Petra could clearly see Carl Baring's face. Or a root, twig and dirt version of his face.
"What's it doing?"
asked Sanders. The doctor studied the creature.
"I think it's dying."
Indeed, now he had said it, it was clear the troll was in trouble. The life was just draining out of it.
"Like the stick insect thing," said Tim.
The troll dropped to the floor. Its writhing skin was falling apart. With sharp, stabbing breaths, it clawed at the ground. Petra felt almost sorry for it. She was reminded of a drowning man fighting for air. The troll looked up and said in a barely audible voice,
"Under the bridge. Come with me."
And stopped. With a rustle, the troll deflated and crumbled into pieces. The doctor took Petra up to the roof. They watched smoke billow over the hills from where Bryant had ordered the carpet bombing. The morning sky was blue and the air carried a faint charred smell. Otherwise, the brown fields were settled after their long night in the storm. They watched two troopers refuel and rearm the helicopter now settled on the lawn. The doctor coughed and spoke.
"I want to thank you for coming back for me, Petra. I would have been dead, or at least forced to come up with a brilliant idea."
She laughed.
"Call it heat of the moment. I'm a coward, I know it."
The doctor appeared to consider that statement.
"Can't have been easy becoming the manager of this place, what with all those non-cowards you would have to beat to the job."
Petra leaned over the old Gothic battlements.
"Oh, it wasn't that hard. Family connections, a generous donation. Despite Carl Baring's fancy words, no one really believes we'll grow anything here. Even Bryant only coughed up his support because of the publicity from Globeaid."
The doctor squinted out at the plume of black smoke in the distance. "Even when the food's running out. Hard to believe."
"Oh, people believe it. They just don't want to do anything about it. They're happy with their corporate distractions. Computers, entertainment systems, virtual holidays. They just expect someone else to sort out their problems for them. A hero."
"A hero," said the doctor. "Not many of them about."
Petra laughed. "In my family, being a hero is traditional, expected. I was just too frightened to say no."
The doctor faced Petra.
"Really?
So tell me, what's a hero?"
"A hero acts even when they know they're going to lose. I don't have that in me."
"Well, hero or not," said the doctor, walking back to the roof hatch, "I'm going to need all the help I can get.
You'll have to be better than nothing."
Petra stared out at the hills.
"Until I let you down?"
"You won't,"
he told her.
This time, Bryant called the meeting. Once again, the volunteers and the soldiers assembled in the common room. Everyone avoided the little patch of vegetation on the carpet that had once been a troll.
"What's this about?"
asked Sanders, voicing everyone's thoughts.
"Don't tell me, Hamilton, it's your turn for story time," said the doctor.
Bryant's smile slipped. He compensated by straightening his silk tie. "Petra, I want you and Katie Baring on board the transport helicopter in 15 minutes. Ignoring the puzzled looks, Bryant pointed at the doctor. "And Lieutenant, place that man under arrest." The doctor's eyes widened with delight.
"Me? What, little old me?"
Chavez stepped in front of the doctor, who smiled. Two soldiers grabbed him.
"Careful,"
he warned.
"I might be dangerous. I might go off at any moment."
The soldiers looked nervously at their officer.
"Not be so stupid," Chavez told them. "Just hold him."
"Merely a precaution, doctor," said Bryant, smiling again. "You understand."
"Bryant, what the hell are you doing?" asked Petra, finally finding her voice. The minister ignored her. Instead, he turned his smile on Tim.
"Professor Hill."
Tim jumped, clearly surprised to be addressed.
"Minister?"
"You're in charge of dealing with the remains of that thing. I want a full autopsy. As for the rest of you..."
Bryant waved vaguely at Sanders and Vanessa.
"You're confined to the Grange."
"You can't just leave us here,"
Vanessa cried.
Bryant stomped to the door. He stopped, theatrically. "I can do whatever I want. We are taking Katie Baring to her brother."
A cellar. Not very imaginative,
but it did the job. Lieutenant Chavez waved his pistol for his prisoner to descend.
"This minister of yours," said the doctor, "you know he's going to get you all killed."
Chavez shrugged. "What can I do?"
"I think you're better than that."
"In you go," said Chavez, "or I'll kill you."
"And I thought you were going to turn out nice," said the doctor.
"Actually, I'm really pleased you're locking me in a cellar. Cellars are actually really interesting. I once had a really interesting time in a cellar. There was me and Rose and an Arcturan and... You really want to hear this?" Chavez slammed the door shut.
The doctor heard two bolts slam into place.
"Or not," he completed his own sentence.
He was standing at the top of some rickety wooden steps. There was a light switch next to the door which did nothing when he flicked it on and off.
"Darky dark cellar then," said the doctor, and skipped down the steps into the gloom.
Upstairs, Dr. Stevenson helped Katie Baring out of bed. Petra noted that Katie's hair was now pure white. She did not seem to know what was happening to her. Petra sure as hell did.
"Bryant," she tried for the 15th time, "you heard the doctor. Taking Katie to the bridge will kill her and us."
"Oh, I don't think so,"
said Stevenson, a particularly oily-looking lackey. Bryant chose his staff very wisely.
"Just what she needs, I'd say. Confront the source of her anguish full on. The sedatives I've given her will absorb any shock. From the monster."
That last word came out as a laugh. Stevenson believed they'd faked the troll. Even now, he really believed that. There was a struggle at the bedroom door. Two troopers were pulling Tim Hill into the room.
"Sir," said Chavez.
Tim Hill looked like he was about to cry. "What have you done?" asked Petra.
"You might as well tell us," said Bryant.
Petra nodded. In this mood, it wasn't worth antagonising the minister.
"Saunders," said Tim. "He's going to walk to the coast."
"What?" Bryant choked.
"He's trying to get to a port, maybe fix up an old battery transmitter."
Chavez threw Tim against the doorframe.
"We'll send a 4x4 to bring him back."
"You won't find him, he knows the fields too well."
Petra nodded. "I have to agree with the minister. If the doctor's right, he'll never make it. We have no idea how far this spheriosis has spread." Petra stared at the botanist. "He must know."
"He does."
Tim's voice was dry.
"He's taken an emergency flare. If he gets into trouble, he's going to send it up. At least we'll learn something about the creature's range."
"Let him go," said Bryant. "He's never going to reach the coast. Anyway, by the time he's got 10 miles, we'll be done."
Petra lost her composure.
"For God's sake, Bryant, you have to help!"
Bryant stepped in front of her.
"Are you going to do it now, Petra? Are you going to give me the excuse I need to replace you?"
"You wouldn't dare. This is a civilian installation. You don't have the authority."
Bryant indicated the two armed soldiers carrying Katie.
"No, Petra, I think you'll find I have all the authority I need. We're 1,000 miles from anywhere. You think anyone's going to care about what happened to one little woman too frightened to cope with real responsibility?"
"You're not taking Katie to the bridge."
Bryant looked at the floor.
"Fair enough. Lieutenant Chavez, shoot that woman."
For a moment, no one moved. The soldiers looked at their officer, who was clearly stunned.
"Minister," he said. "Is your hearing defective, Lieutenant? I said, shoot Petra Lancaster."
Petra felt her insides turn to jelly.
"You have no right," she began.
"Under Article 12 of the Eurozone State of Emergency Act, I surely do."
Chavez's mouth was dry.
"Sir?" "Those are my orders, Lieutenant. Shoot her or I'll have you arrested."
Chavez unclipped his automatic pistol and pointed it at Petra.
"Step down, Miss Lancaster."
He was practically pleading her. Petra glared at Bryant. She knew what she had to do, what was being asked of her. This was her moment, and she wasn't up to it. Petra sat down at the children's table.
"All right," she said, "all right."
Bryant waved at Chavez to put his gun away. The minister studied the assembled company.
"Any more questions?"
There was something moving in the dark. On the ground? No. It was the ground. The bare cellar earth was trembling. The spheriosis was under the house. Always had been.
"Okay," said the doctor. That means you're massive, doesn't it?
The ground pulsed as if gigantic arteries were pumping blood up to some impossibly large heart. The doctor stood up on an old table, hoping its wobbly legs would hold. The movement subsided. The cellar floor was still again. The doctor heard a mechanical thumping from outside. The heavy transport helicopter was taking off. He hoped for a wild second he had actually taken his advice and decided to evacuate the Grange, but he doubted it. Bryant was up for blood. The doctor looked around for convenient door hinges, screws, or plain old locks to start working on. If that helicopter had gone to the bridge, they were going to need his help very soon. Katie Baring did not react when the troops carried her into the waiting helicopter. Now they were airborne, however, Petra saw some life return to those dulled eyes.
"Are we going home now?" Katie asked.
Bryant shoved Petra back into her seat to pat the girl's shoulder. "Soon. First we're going to see Carl."
A frown creased Katie's temple.
"Carl?"
Bryant nodded.
"You'd like to see Carl again, wouldn't you?"
"Oh, yes. I'd like to see Carl again."
"Bryant," said Petra, "you have no idea what you're doing."
The minister glanced at the sick, smiling girl.
"Oh, I think I have some idea."
"Carl's dead," said Petra.
"Sorry, Katie."
Katie grasped Petra's arm.
"But I saw him. Carl visited me."
"No, that was something... something using his body. Carl's gone."
Katie looked at Bryant, shocked.
"Is that true?"
Bryant shook his head. "No, Katie, it isn't. You'll see him again, I promise."
Katie sat back, looking tired. Petra wanted to punch Bryant, beat him into understanding. But the memory of her failure at the Grange kicked in, and she closed her eyes instead. Better to block it all out. The minister seemed to understand the decision she had just made.
"Good girl, Petra. Just leave everything to me.
Now sit back and enjoy the ride."
The helicopter touched down at the top of the scorched riverbank. The sloping ground was black, the earth torn up under high explosive. In patches, the soil had melted hard as glass. 500 metres away, spanning the dried-out river, the bridge still stood. Despite the incredible amount of heat poured onto the structure was intact. A skeleton, yes, but still resolutely, stubbornly there. Dr. Stevenson helped Katie out of the helicopter. She was shaky but functional. Covering his eyes and bent over, Bryant led his team out from the swirling downdraft and gave the pilot the thumbs up. The helicopter lifted off, circling the riverbed. Something popped to the south, its echo ringing round the silent countryside. 8 heads looked to the hills. Only Katie remained oblivious. Far away, a thin line of purple smoke rose into the silent evening sky.
"Sanders," said Petra.
"It reaches that far."
Bryant was silent, watching the flare arc and drop.
"Well, that's a morale boost," said Petra. "What's this supposed to achieve, Bryant?"
Bryant turned to look down on the bridge, and Petra wondered suddenly if he was scared.
"Oh, I think you know. It is my belief that Carl Baring is under that bridge. Alive."
"Are you serious? Under the bridge? The bridge you bombed?"
"Yes," said Katie. "Under the bridge."
The girl freed herself from Dr. Stevenson's grip and walked to the top of the riverbank. Petra stepped forward but hesitated before the barrel of a trooper's machine pistol.
"That's right, Katie," said Bryant. "Go to Carl."
Katie Baring breathed in the smoke-spoiled air.
"Carl," she called out. "I'm here."
The troopers were spooked, fidgeting with their guns. The atmosphere was heightened, electric with tension. The dusty ground was quiet. Even the wind was still. Katie walked lightly down the slope.
"Someone stop this," Petra called out to the soldiers. "Can't you see what's going to happen?"
The guards looked uncomfortable, but did nothing.
"Lieutenant Chavez," she tried.
The officer was staring at the bridge.
"Something about it," he said. "Something wrong."
Bryant looked warily at the officer.
"Lieutenant?"
Katie had reached the riverbed now, a broad smile on her face.
"I'm coming, Carl. I'm coming under the bridge."
She seemed to glide along the glassy soil. Petra knew she shouldn't. She knew she should not do anything stupid, that she wouldn't get away with it. But sometimes, just sometimes, you had to.
Oh, for God's sake, Katie, stop! She ran forward, waving. When she reached the lip of the slope, Chavez shot her.
Petra felt something very hard and impossibly painful kick her in the back and sent her tumbling down the bank.
Shot, she thought through her pain. They shot me.
The annoying truth about being locked in this particular cellar, thought the doctor, was that Chavez had in fact chosen a very good cellar to lock him in. Good as in hard to get out of. He didn't dare risk standing on the floor because that dark earthen ground looked very hungry. Rumblings underground told him something was coming. Unfortunately, there wasn't anything handy he could reach, let alone use. He was marooned on a table. How embarrassing, he said. The underground thumping began again. I'm going to have to run for the stairs, the doctor told himself. Lousy idea, but beggars can't be choosers. And with that, he leapt for the wooden staircase. Something large and squelchy burst out from the ground behind him and smashed the table into pieces. He slammed into the door and shouted, "Is anybody up there?" Something rather like an elephant's trunk made of white roots was probing the cellar. It squirmed round empty bottles, stacked shelves and all the usual rubbish you'd find in a cellar. Unfortunately, there was not a lot for it to eat. If he shouted again, would he attract the trunk's attention? Probably. What were the options? He turned and thumped on the wood. Hello? You've got about 5 seconds to get me out. Yes, he was totally out of luck. The trunk, or whatever it was, stopped crashing about and felt its way to the bottom step. Hello? The doctor bellowed. The trunk rose into the air, darted around as if trying to pick up a scent, and then shot up at him. The doctor heard a bolt scrape back. He ducked. The trunk smashed into the door, perhaps distracted by the sound. The second bolt scraped as the earthen limb recoiled and prepared for another strike. The cellar door opened. The doctor threw himself into the corridor. He felt the air move with the whip of the creature's limb. Close it! He yelled. Vanessa slammed the door shut just as the trunk hammered into it. The doctor paused for breath. Thank you, he said. Vanessa was still and trembling and clearly had done as much as she was going to do. The doctor piled chairs against the door as the trunk smashed against the other side. His defences barely held the wood in place. He smiled at Vanessa. We'd better run. He grabbed her hand and did just that. Noises ran round the grange. They sounded like gigantic rats burrowing beneath the building. Every now and then the doctor heard loud snaps as centuries-old solid floorboards were torn open. Spheriosis seemed happy to dismember the grange to get to the goodies inside.
I can't find anyone, Vanessa said. I heard sounds.
He nodded. It's okay, it's fine. You see, I'm here. That'll be enough. The Spheriosis has decided to go for broke. It must be hungrier than I thought. Let's try the lab.
I heard noises in there. I didn't go in.
The grange shook under tremendous pounding. We have to move, the doctor told Vanessa. We have to get out of the grange.
I can't, said Vanessa.
The doctor considered her words. That's very nice of you. You see, eating you will distract the Spheriosis long enough for me to get away. Thanks. Or...
I can,
said Vanessa. That's right. Now, those noises in the lab were probably Tim. Remember Bryant asked him to do an autopsy on the troll? Vanessa was drifting away. Shock and fear. The doctor wondered how she got picked to come on this project anyway, then realised it was probably something to do with humans and money. He led her through the trembling corridors as quietly as he could manage. Dust from the smashed-up floors was creeping along after them. Every now and then, a wall would shake as something heavy thumped against it. At last, they reached the closed door of the lab. The doctor put his ear to the wood, but couldn't hear anything. We'll go through the outside door to the garage, he told the traumatized girl. Got to get hold of transport. She just held on. The doctor turned the handle and walked into the laboratory. The room was empty and quiet. The computers hummed and blinked, performing their myriad botanical tasks. The doctor pulled Vanessa inside, closed the door and slid the bolts home. No sign of Tim, he told her, but I think we're safe enough. Vanessa squealed as she caught sight of something. The doctor looked to see only a pile of vegetable matter flung onto a lab table, what had once been the trawl.
There we go, nothing to worry about, he told her.
He stopped talking. He heard a rustle in one corner. Something was sliding across the floor. A glass bottle rolled and rattled. Vanessa screamed. The doctor angrily waved her to shut up. The girl sat down on the floor, too hysterical even to cry. Slowly, the doctor moved past the table holding the troll's remains.
Hello,
he whispered and looked. Tim Hill was entwined in the long, feathery feelers of the spheriosis. A hole in the wooden floor revealed its point of entrance. Tim himself was halfway down that hole. The limbs wrapped around him were slowly drawing the life out of the botanist. Tim seemed to collapse inwards as the roots pulsed with energy. The spheriosis was drinking him alive. There was no point in doing anything to help. The doctor just hoped Tim was no longer conscious enough to know what was going on. All right, said the doctor. That's it. I know you're only obeying your biological imperative, but you've taken too much. Live too long. I'm going to stop you. The limb reacted to his voice, pulling Tim completely through the wooden hole. The doctor heard other roots moving through the earth to come for him. There's got to be a way to stop you, said the doctor, and I'll find it, believe me. The floor behind him smashed apart. There was a deafening hiss as a forest of roots burst up. The doctor turned to face them as they thrashed. He scrabbled backwards, trying to reach Vanessa to protect her. As he did so, he reached up an arm and accidentally pulled the cold remains of the troll down on top of himself. And then he knew. The troll. The doctor reached Vanessa and shoved her beneath a lab table. He turned to face the creeping roots. Listen to me, spheriosis, he said. You can hear me. I know you can. When you mixed your genes with Carl Baring, it wasn't all one way, was it? The forest of roots crept closer, but a teensy bit slower, he thought. Why did you come for Katie in the middle of the night? The thrashing roots wavered. Carl's in you somewhere. Enough Carl to let me go. And Katie. I can get Katie away. I can make her safe. The roots retreated. There was a pathway to the outside door. The doctor pulled Vanessa out from beneath the table. I can stop this, he said. Grinning, the doctor reversed the 4x4 out from the garage. I love your cars, he yelled. Looking at Vanessa's trembling face, he realised she didn't share his enthusiasm. She stood by the open garage door, pressing herself into the wall. Oh, come on, he said through the window. It's not that bad. Something huge inside the Grange smashed brick and stone apart. All right, stupid thing to say, obviously it is that bad. Where are you going? She asked. Get in, tell you on the way. No, tell me now! The doctor felt a flare of irritation, then immediately stopped himself. Vanessa had gone beyond her limits. All right, but you have to do something for me. The girl trembled. I'm not going to the bridge. All right, he replied. I won't make you. What did you mean when you said we've been missing everything? I haven't got time. Okay, I've got a bit of time. You remember when I found Katie in the road? No, Vanessa replied. I wasn't there. She told me the troll said not under the bridge. Not come under the bridge, which he told everyone else. I didn't pick up on that. Also, I found Katie in the road. I thought the troll had dropped her to get away. It hadn't. It was trying to get her away. Blimey, I was wrong twice. You won't tell anyone, will you? Get her away. If anyone goes under that bridge, they're food. Bam. Not even Carl can stop that. Goodbye. If that's happened to Katie, we've lost. The doctor revved the engine again. I don't understand, Vanessa wailed. The doctor thumped the steering wheel with frustration. That troll, which was mainly Carl Baring still, wasn't getting her to go under the bridge. It was trying to get her away from the bridge. As the troll, Carl had enough influence to try and save his sister. Once you're actually under the bridge, it's Furiosus all the way. He can't save her there. At last, Vanessa was calm. All right, she said. So what do you want me to do? The doctor opened the vehicle door. Take this vehicle and drive to the coast. I'll take one of the others. Now listen, if I lose, the spheriosis will control this whole island. You have to tell whoever you find to leave Britain alone. Let the spheriosis starve. Now, Vanessa, do you think you can do that? Just drive to the coast. She nodded. The doctor got out of the 4x4 and she climbed in. Vanessa revved the engine. So how can you lose if you know how to beat it? It's one thing knowing. Knowing isn't always enough.
If Bryant has got Katie under the bridge, this is already over.
Vanessa looked at the doctor.
If that's the case, why don't you come to the coast with me?
He shrugged and kicked at the dust.
Not possible, he told her. Not in my nature. I have to try. Can't help myself. My own worst enemy, really, but there you go.
He clapped his hands.
Come on, get going!
Vanessa put the 4x4 into gear with a loud, grinding crunch. She looked at the doctor, tears of shame running down her face.
Sorry, doctor.
The doctor smiled.
Your loss.
And with that he turned and hared back into the garage. The first real thing Katie Baring understood in a long time was that her friend Petra had been shot. Until then, the world had been a terrifying confusion of noise and light, with only the bright voice of her brother guiding her through. Now, there was Petra at the bottom of the bank, the echo of a fired gun and the smell of smoke. Katie realised she was walking on charred ground. The force of the real world coming back to her was overpowering. It made her feel dizzy, made her fall. She realised she was running to her friend. The realisation made Katie stumble. She held out a hand to save herself, and the earth she grabbed was warm. Petra Lancaster was on her back, staring up. Her eyes were moist. Her lips moved in short, painful breaths. Katie heard a man's voice somewhere in the distance shout, but she paid it no mind. Katie wanted to help. Where was Carl? Katie, said a weak voice. Petra, her face caked in dust and sweat. She was shivering. Her fingers wiggled. Katie knelt by her friend's side. Men were gathering at the top of the bank to look. Katie took Petra's hand. I'm here, she said. Katie was shocked at how strange her own voice sounded. She had been somewhere else for so long. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Don't go under the bridge, said Petra. The doctor told me. They'll make you. Run.
Petra closed her eyes. There was no cover, nowhere to hide, and the men were fitter and faster than she was. Katie ran anyway.
Food Minister Bryant was irritated. He had come to the Grange to sort out this mess and faced nothing but mutiny. These people just didn't appreciate rescue. Now, Petra Lancaster was lying short, and Katie Baring, for some reason, was running away from those who had come to save her.
Petra wouldn't be much of a problem. He could cover that up. He'd done similar work before. But the sister of Carl Baring was another matter. A treacherous part of his brain was beginning to think Carl really was beyond recovery, which meant it was vital to keep the sister intact. Vital for his triumphant return to Madrid and to the success of the subsequent inquiry. Chavez marched up to the food minister. What about that flare? It doesn't matter, said Bryant. Get the girl, get someone down that bank and get her under the bridge, then we'll evacuate. Chavez seemed perturbed by his words. More stubborn refusal, more mutiny. Sir, with respect, I think we should evacuate now. Bryant turned on him.
You've just shot an unarmed woman in the back, Lieutenant. Do you really want that to be your last act before going home?
Chavez glared at him.
No, sir. Then do as I say. Get Katie Baring under that bridge. Yes, sir. Angrily, Chavez pointed down the bank. Stamper, Dr. Stevenson, get down there.
Dr. Stevenson didn't hurry. Katie wasn't going to get away. She was climbing the opposite bank, but moving far too slowly ever to think she could seriously escape them. He stopped running. Katie was about 10 metres up the gentle slope. Corporal Stamper at his side raised his machine pistol and fired into the earthen bank. Dust spat from the slope. Katie halted.
It's all right, darling, said the corporal. Stay there. That'll do, Katie, Stevenson called out. We only want to help you.
Stamper turned to face Stevenson. Both were panting.
Well, go on, he told the corporal. Go and get her.
Lieutenant Chavez followed Bryant down the bank. The remaining three troops stayed up top in case something went awry. Bryant and Chavez stepped over Petra's unmoving body and reached the riverbed. The four of them marched Katie to the bridge. There was little left of the supports, just blackened brick and scorched ironwork. an old ruin in a wasteland. Bryant wasn't going to be intimidated by a ruin. Just the same, as soon as he got back, he was going to order a rocket strike to wipe this whole area from the face of the planet, Carl Baring or no Carl Baring. "What exactly are we doing here?" asked Katie. Her defiance seemed odd from a woman who had seemed comatose only minutes earlier. Bryant realised, perhaps for the first time, just what kind of shock she must have undergone. Katie took a deep breath. She looked on the verge of tears, but she found the courage to say, "My brother is dead, Minister. I know that now." Bryant nodded. He kicked up some dust. The shadowed bridge waited for them.
"I understand, Katie. I do."
And then he slapped her. Even the soldiers were shocked. Chavez put an arm on the minister, who shoved him off.
"Don't touch me," he snarled. "I know what you're doing. You're trying to pin the blame for the failure of this stupid farm on me. Monster plants don't make me laugh. I know why you don't want to go under the bridge."
Bryant wiped the spit from his mouth and pointed at the bridge.
"Because there's nothing there. Nothing. You think I'm an idiot? And when you see your brother, wherever he's hiding, you tell him I know the truth. I know what's going on."
With that, Bryant hauled a handkerchief from his suit pocket to wipe the sweat from his face.
"Take her," he muttered.
Stamper grabbed Katie's shoulder. "Let's get this done, miss." He and Stevenson frog-marched her to the brick-shrouded shadows. Katie struggled, still defiant. Stevenson clutched her other shoulder. "He'll get us all killed," she said. Suddenly, Stamper stopped and looked at his feet.
"What the hell is that?"
The ground began to turn, shaking and bubbling like water boiling out of a pot. The corporal looked at the equally bemused Katie, then back at Bryant. Long, thin, white arms burst from the ground and yanked Stamper under the soil. One second he was there, the next, gone. Dr. Stevenson didn't need any hints. He shoved Katie away, turned, and ran. As he did so, he realised something was coming out of the ground after him, something that scuttled on clacking legs. He tried to increase his pace, but a hot bundle of twigs leapt for his back and knocked him down. More scratching, biting balls of twigs were on him. He tried to fight, but they swarmed all over his body. Stevenson was vaguely aware that the ground beneath him was opening up, and as the creatures covered him, he was going under.
"Help me!"
he yelled. Stevenson stopped fighting to scrabble at the ground into which he was sinking. His fingers found only loose earth. Then he was gone. Bryant and Lieutenant Chavez stared as Katie ran back to them, earth churning around her. The creatures spewed out of the ground, tumbling over each other in a threshing, buzzing jumble. Bryant grabbed his officer's arm. "Call the helicopter and get me out of here!" Chavez's response wasn't exactly out of the manual. He shoved his boss out of the way and ran. The twig creatures disentangled themselves enough to give chase.
"Wait!" Bryant wailed. "Save me!"
Such was Bryant's panic, he simply refused to accept Chavez had no chance of ever carrying out such an order. The officer was too busy thrashing away at the creatures now crawling all over him. Chavez threw one of the creatures off, but the ground beneath opened up and he too started to sink. He pulled his pistol and calmly began firing at the creatures. As wood burst into splinters, more crawling legs flickered up from below. Bryant realised there was no way to escape. Except Katie. Nothing was happening to her. Whatever was attacking his men was leaving her entirely alone. As she came close, Bryant threw his arms around the girl. He closed his eyes so he didn't have to see Chavez waist deep in the ground stop struggling and put the pistol to his own head. Bryant kept his eyes firmly shut as the shot rang out. When the minister looked again, Chavez was gone. The creatures clacked and scuttled, casting about for new prey. Their beady, expressionless eyes settled on Bryant as he hugged the girl.
"Save me," he moaned. "Please." "I don't know how," Katie replied.
She was trembling too. Creatures crawled closer. Suddenly, there was a huge thump from behind them. Bryant and Katie turned to see a 4x4 lurch dangerously down the bank, handbrake turn a tight 45 degrees in the dust, and reverse at speed to the bridge. Brakes squealed and the vehicle skidded to a stop. Even the creatures paused to watch. Electric windows dropped down. The doctor's beaming face poked out. "Someone order a taxi?" Bryant and Katie didn't need asking twice. The 4x4 rocked as the earth erupted behind them. In the rearview mirror, the doctor saw a single gigantic tentacle, again made of earth and roots, rise from the trail the vehicle had made. Similar to the tentacle he had seen in the Grange, but much, much, much bigger. "Strap yourselves in," he told his passengers. "We're in for a bumpy ride. By the way, where's Petra?" Katie Baring bit her lip. She looked at Bryant beside her. "She came to help me. They shot her." Bryant was unable to meet the stare in the mirror. "I could have stopped all this," said the doctor, "but you had to know better." Bryant twisted round to look behind. He flinched as he saw the gigantic limb rising higher and higher. "How big is that thing?" "As big as it needs to be," the doctor replied, "but I don't think it's after us anymore." Indeed, now Katie and Bryant looked, they saw the limb was rising into the sky. It wasn't chasing them at all. The tentacle was as wide as a house and as high as a block of flats. Still, it grew. The doctor pushed hard on the brake. The 4x4 screeched to a stop. "What the hell are you doing?" screamed Bryant. "Keep going, keep going! Do you think we'd outrun the Spheriosis if it was really after us?" Katie stared in disbelief at the rising limb. "So, what is it doing?" The doctor thought. "I don't know." The tentacle was half a kilometre high now. Mud and dust and roots were falling off it, but still it rose. It looked like a giant segmented chimney. The doctor opened the door and got out for a better look. "Get back here!" bellowed Bryant from inside. The doctor pointed at the chimney. "I do know." "Of course!" Katie followed him. "What? What is it?" "Your brother. He's forcing the Spheriosis to burn its stores of energy. The thing must be running on empty. Carl Baring is forcing the Spheriosis to use itself up." "Why?" asked Katie. "To protect you." He looked up at the tentacle again. "He wants to save his sister. Carl's part of it now, forcing it to grow. He must know it hasn't got much energy left." "What about all the people it's ingested?" Katie looked sick. "Won't they feed it?" "Not nearly enough, not at the rate he's making it work." He yelled at the tentacle. "You're too greedy, aren't you, Mr. Spheriosis? You've grown too large." Katie shielded her eyes and watched. The ground was shaking, and there was a tremendous noise, like an army of underground trains was driving through. And then the noise stopped. Silence. The absolute silence of an empty England. The huge tentacle was just still, high in the air, higher than anything for miles around. Even Bryant found the courage to get out of the car. "What's happened?" asked the minister. "Impasse," said the doctor. The tentacle shuddered. The doctor thought quickly, speaking as he did so. If Carl had won, the creature would be falling to pieces. If the Spheriosis had suppressed Carl's instincts, we'd all be dead. Ergo, impasse. No score draw. "Won't last long, though." As he spoke, the ground shuddered again. Bryant jumped and ran back to the 4x4. "We need to get to the helicopter," he murmured, squinting into the grey sky. "Where is it? Where's my helicopter?" The doctor shielded his eyes from the sun to get a better look at the tentacle. He seemed totally unaffected by the shaking ground. "Probably halfway to Calais, along with the rest of your brave lads. Past them, legging it on my way here." The tentacle shuddered. Katie grabbed the doctor's arm. "Look!" A few metres ahead, a fountain of earth bubbled up. A pulsing white head forced its way to the surface. Two blank eye holes regarded them. "The troll," said the doctor. The 4x4 roared into life. The doctor and Katie heard Bryant crunch the gears and he skidded off, churning the trembling ground as he went. "He left us," Katie moaned. The doctor was calm. "Yep." The troll wriggled out of its hole. Slowly, it got to its feet. "So what do we do?" The doctor took a deep breath and held Katie by the shoulders. "We've only got one chance.
one chance to end this. Katie grasped his shoulder, full of hope.
What? What do we do?
The troll stood still, watching them. More fountains of earth were rising now, and more white arms punched out.
There's more than one troll, said Katie.
Listen, the doctor told her. If Carl was completely out of it, we'd be finished already. The Spheriosis is trying something new to get round his influence. We have to encourage Carl, keep him strong.
And how do we do that?
By putting you in maximum danger. The doctor grabbed Katie's hand and ran. The troll regarded them as they went. Katie yanked him to a stop.
You're joking, she screeched.
No!
He turned and gave her a rueful shrug. Afraid so. Under the bridge.
After all this!
She pulled her hand out of his grasp.
You're joking.
It's your decision. I'm going anyway. Yes, I'm increasing the odds of the Spheriosis ingesting us, but I'm hoping it'll keep your brother fighting. As the trolls grew around them, the doctor was smiling again.
A choice, choice. Care to join me?
Bryant sped dangerously along the river gully. Surely he had outrun the creature, but he didn't care. Anywhere but here, as quickly as possible. Road, he mumbled. Gotta get to the road. Something the size of a child thumped onto the vehicle's bonnet. Bryant shrank back into his seat as a troll creature looked at him. Its hands left mucky splodges on the glass. Bryant screamed and aimed the 4x4 up the bank. Just as he realised his mistake, the front bumpers cannoned into dirt and stones. The impact was hard enough to activate the vehicle's airbag. It blew up in his face, pinning him into his seat. The vehicle stalled. The engine died.
No, 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 Bryant moaned.
Tiny hands scratched at the driver's door. Ignoring the sound, Bryant reached round the bubble trapping him and twisted the ignition key. The engine coughed into life.
Yes,
he yelled. He stabbed the airbag, trying to burst the wretched thing. Another thump, something landing on the roof. The driver's door handle rattled. Bryant fumbled blindly at the gear stick. He stamped on the accelerator. The engine roared and the wheels span in the ground. At last, somehow, he knocked the airbag out of his way. Another troll joined its twin, watching him through the windscreen. They studied his frantic efforts.
Get away from my car,
Bryant bellowed. And now a whole pack of the creatures was climbing onto the 4x4. The whole vehicle lurched downwards. Something had seized the car from below. Bryant stamped, but now the wheels didn't even spin. Groping feelers like thick, pulpy string threaded inside through tiny holes in the floor. They bobbed up and down, searching.
Not me, Bryant pleaded. Please, not me.
He grabbed the door handle. A feathery tendril stroked his hand. The trolls watched through the windows as the vehicle filled with writhing, fibrous roots. They were under the bridge. The air was colder, but that seemed to be the only difference to outside. Katie shivered. After all the fuss. The doctor inspected the supports.
There has to be something, a hole, a door, I don't know. He sniffed. Interesting choice of larder. I guess there's some organising collective nerve cluster here.
A load of veggie brain cells tucked away to manage the link from the surface down to the central kernel deep underground. The ground rumbled. The doctor looked out from under the bridge. The tentacle was moving. It lowered itself to the ground, its mass filling the cutting. It approached the bridge like a tsunami. The earth thundered. The doctor looked at Katie.
You'll go, he said.
She nodded. She swallowed and looked up at the brick arches.
Carl, if you're here, end this. I love you and I want you to be free.
She looked at the doctor.
I feel silly.
The doctor eyed the approaching wall of earth. Not as silly as we're going to feel in about 30 seconds.
There is no Carl,
came a booming voice. The doctor whipped round to see a troll standing at the arch of the bridge, silhouetted in the light. Katie shrieked. The tentacle rolled toward them. The air, pushed by the force of its movement, rocked the bridge like a gale.
You can do it, Carl, she said. You have never given up on anything in your life. Come on, Carl, I love you.
The troll raised its arms and bellowed.
There is no Carl, only me. 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 No!
creature doubled up as if in pain. It dropped to its knee and looked up.
Katie,
it said.
Katie.
Its face twisted and the creature staggered, trying to get away.
No!
It bellowed. Oi, troll! Snapped the doctor. He ran and grabbed the creature's right arm. Come under, he yelled. Come under the bridge with me. He hauled the troll into the shadows and threw it at Katie. She looked into the creature's face and saw him there. Carl, she whispered. He looked at his sister for the last time. She held him tight. The tentacle roared towards them. The troll turned away, crumbling in her embrace. It gave a last sigh and peeled apart. The doctor dived on top of them. Katie shrieked, "Eyes down!" yelled the doctor. Seconds before impact, the immense, unstoppable tentacle disintegrated into earth and root and stone and blasted over the bridge. The country was silent again. Nothing moved. Nothing moved in the wind but dust. The bridge was gone. Nothing now but a hill of soil. Until someone pushed and sent a clump of earth rolling to the ground, creating a hole in the hill. The doctor wriggled out. He rolled over and pulled a similarly filthy Katie out after him. Together, they slid to the riverbed. We did it, Katie said. The doctor brushed himself down. Gonna need some serious dry cleaning. Yeah, I think so. Carl. He stopped and looked at Katie. Yes, she replied. Carl killed it, the doctor told her. With your help. Oh, and mine, of course. Something moved on the bank. It groaned. A half-buried body. My God, said Katie, that's Petra. 20 meters away from the ruined bridge, Petra Lancaster raised her head and smiled weakly. She was filthy and half buried and clearly in serious pain, but she was still alive. The doctor and Katie ran to her. She needs medical attention right now, said the doctor. I was a medical student, said Katie, in another life. Perhaps I will be again. Petra? Petra spat out a mouthful of earth and groaned. That'll do, said Katie. A mechanical roar split the silent air. The transport helicopter. All three watched in wonder as it landed at the top of the riverbank. So, somebody didn't run after all, said the doctor. You humans, each one of you totally different. Some run and some stay, and you can never tell why, or when, or who. They'll have everything I need for Petra, said Katie. I can save her. Petra smiled faintly. Thanks, she managed. I'm going now, said the doctor. You don't need me getting in the way. Even your little farm should start working now there's nothing draining away everything you grow. He stood up, casting a worried look towards where his TARDIS should have been. You'll be all right without me, won't you? Katie looked at Petra. Both women smiled wearily. Why not? Said Katie. After all, there's nothing to be scared of. Doctor Who, The Day of the Troll, was written by Simon Messingham and read by David Tennant. It was produced by Kate Thomas and is published by BBC Audiobooks.
Doctor Who, The Last Voyage, by Dan Abnett. Read by David Tennant. A pink glow was flickering around the edges of the mirrored windows. Apart from that, there was absolutely no sense of them being in motion. There was no vibration, no tremble coming up through the deck under her feet. Nothing at all, in fact, except the distant background murmur of the transpositional engines. Sugar Macaulay thought that it was a bit of a disappointment, to be honest. Given the unimaginable distances they were travelling and the mind-blowing velocities involved, she felt that there really ought to be something more spectacular to show for it than a flickering pink glow around the edges of the windows. Sugar adjusted her uniform. Novilunar Corporation's design division had gone for a retro, quasi-military meets baton twirler look. Marketing said it accented the refined and genteel lines of the passenger salons and spoke of a halcyon age of travel. That was all very well, but the scarlet hussar-cut coat was made of a scratchy neo-weave material, and the winged chrome helmet refused to sit up straight on her head. She blinked twice to summon up her lashboard, the little retinal hololink that kept her data synced. She checked the time on her body clock display. They had been in transit for almost an hour, which meant the trip was just about two-thirds done. Sugar blinked her lashboard away again and surveyed the executive class salon of the ship. No, not a ship, Sugar. Not a ship. An interstitial transposition vehicle. Get it right, she told herself. Novilunar was very hot on product identity. This wasn't just a ship. This was a staggering revolution in interstellar transit. All of the transfer clients seemed content. There were 79 of them in the executive salon and another 740 in the main salon a deck below. On the executive level, the clients were sitting in luxurious booths and nests of chairs, each seating zone screened by audio and visual discretion fields. Sugar could see mouths talking, laughing and chattering, but no sound drifted back to her. With professional diligence, she studied each client group in turn to see which of them needed her attention. Not the Dowager Colette with her awful yapping luck dogs. Not the data mogul with a dozen identical clone assistants. Not the famous virtual dancer sipping her detoxed cocktail. Not the honeymooners, who only had eyes for each other. They were all lottery winners, every one of them, just like Sugar and the rest of the crew. The only person on board the vessel who wasn't there by chance was Joseph Stearns Cluxton. From where she was standing in the service alcove of the executive salon, Sugar could see Joseph Stearns Cluxton perfectly well. He was a tall, gangly man in his late 160s, with watery blue eyes and slightly too much chin. Like many uber-wealthy types, he'd elected to have very little work done. He hadn't had a hair transfer, or a skin polymer, or any of the other things Sugar might have suggested he was in need of. His clothes were very simple and made of old-tech fabrics like cotton and something called linen. Cluxton affected a look that the celebrity fashionistas like to call vintage authenticism. It took a great deal of money to look that unmoneyed. Luckily, Cluxton was the 16th wealthiest man in the Empire. He was also the reason they were all there today. Cluxton had discovered the Cluxton Quantum Potentiality Principle. Cluxton had designed the E-Slam transpositional engines that were, at that very moment, slicing them through interstitial reality. It wouldn't be long before Cluxton became the wealthiest man in the Empire, full stop. Sugar wondered what eternity would be like when they got there. She hoped it would be nice. Apparently there was going to be a huge turnout to greet them. Eternity had declared arrival day a public holiday and the entire population was expected to converge on the terminal. Lizzie was making her way up the main aisle towards Sugar. Lizzie paused to deliver another dish of complimentary macadamia nuts to the strange, quiet man sitting alone in booth 8. Sugar loved her friend Lizzie Fisk. Lizzie made being a comfort mediator look effortless. Lizzie wore the scratchy, scarlet neo-weave jacket as if it was tailored silk and kept the winged chrome helmet perched on her clouds of pre-Raphaelite red hair as though it weighed nothing. Credit for them? Lizzie asked as she slipped into the alcove beside Sugar.
Just thinking, you know,
Sugar replied. We're almost there, said Lizzie, quickly consulting her own lashboard.
I know. What will it be like when we arrive?
Sugar asked.
Lizzie shrugged. I don't know, but it can't come soon enough, she growled. The kids with a couple in four are too young for this, and they shouldn't have been allowed on board.
They are running me ragged.
And watch the male twins in 16.
A bit handsy, asked Sugar.
Lizzie scowled and shook her head.
I wish. They've got some sort of virtual weirdness going on. I swear I was stark naked when I served them their mojitos.
Sugar laughed. And don't start me on Cluxton, Lizzie continued. She shot an angry look in the direction of the famous man himself. Cluxton was deep in animated conversation with his secretary, his two aides, six journalists, and a mousy little man that Sugar understood to be Cluxton's biographer.
I know he's very clever and everything, said Lizzie. Whoop-de-doo, yes, we're all very impressed, Mr. Cluxton. Now can you stop touching my behind like you own it and ordering champagne like it's an all-you-can-drink chuggathon? Is he really that bad?
Sugar asked.
He's a total nerk, Lizzie replied. Did his last order come up yet?
I haven't lashed it, Sugar said.
They both blinked up their lashboards. There was nothing showing on the orders pending field.
Galley's forgotten it, Lizzie began. I'm sure it's no problem, Sugar told her. Could you check it for me, sweetie? Lizzie asked.
Yeah, I'll go right down, Sugar assured her.
Make it quick, though, Lizzie said. Cluxton will lose it if his bubbly runs out.
She smiled at Sugar. I do it myself, but I want to check on the guy in 8. He's travelling alone, and he's cute. Sugar grinned.
Fraternization is not allowed, she said.
I know, Lizzie grinned back. I'm just intrigued.
I think he's something, a secret agent or something. He's got hidden depths.
Good luck,
Sugar told her, and walked towards the stairs. She turned back.
I really wish this was more dramatic, Lizzie, she said.
What? Lizzie replied.
Don't you think that this should be more dramatic? Sugar asked. I mean, the pink glow just flickering, it's not really all that amazing.
This? Lizzie asked, pointing at the nearest mirrored window. The pink glow was quietly shimmering around its edges.
Oh, baby, you didn't know. This isn't real. It's just lights in the window frame. They put them in to simulate some sense of progress, because without them, the whole process might have seemed too quiet and weird. You're kidding.
Lizzie shook her head.
True story, she said. The bottom line is, transposition is a very strange thing. It's almost like space moves and we don't or something. I don't understand it, really.
Sugar grinned and shook her head.
Me neither, she said.
Sugar went down the companionway into the interdeck service area. There was a quiet, carpeted hallway that led to the galley annex and the provision stores. Away from the insulated public decks, there was a little more noise. Sugar could hear the rasping whir of the air circulation plant and the drone of the galley's extractor vents. The murmur of the transpositional engines was a little louder too. Someone said her name. Sugar jumped and looked behind her, but there was no one there. She was alone in the corridor. She frowned and then blinked up her lashboard in case someone had sent her speech mail. Nothing.
Hello?
She called. No one answered. The air circulation plant continued to whir and the engines continued to murmur.
It must have been my imagination, she decided.
Sugar entered the galley where six cuisine preparation artificials were silently working through the pending meal orders. She checked the wall log and tutted when she saw that there was no record of Cluxton's drink order on the updating graphic display. She blinked and connected a speech link to Lizzie in the salon.
There's no order, Sugar said.
She heard Lizzie mutter to herself quietly.
I'll fill it by hand, Sugar said. What did he want? 3 bottles of the 81 Tattinger and a carton of chilled glasses should do the trick. Thanks, Sugar.
No problem,
Sugar replied, heading out of the galley towards the provision stores.
I've got to run, said Lizzie over the link. The little old lady in 19 is complaining that she keeps hearing voices.
Yeah?
Yeah, someone keeps saying her name. Bye!
The link disconnected. Sugar paused and frowned.
Weird.
She shook her head and turned the corner into Provision Store 1. The girl coming the other way almost